12 minutes past 7 on Morning Ireland, a day after AIB surprised us with a cut in mortgage costs. Two of its biggest rivals are talking about their state of health to the markets this morning. Emma McNamara is with us. We're talking about Ulster Bank and Bank of Ireland.
Bank of Ireland first, and neither of them are mentioning interest rates that people might have on their mortgages. It's not really a day for that. In the case of Ulster Bank, its results for the first 9 months of the year, or the last previous 3 months, its third quarter, and an interim management statement from Bank of Ireland this morning.
Okay, well, which is the more interesting?
Let's start with Bank of Ireland and its loans. It says that total defaulted loans across its portfolios are still falling. Irish mortgage early and default arrears continue to reduce in the 3 months of the year, of what it's talking about this morning, with reductions in both owner-occupied and buy-to-let mortgage books. And the bank says that this is because of the action it's been taking, and it expects asset quality trends to continue to improve, and it expects further reductions in impairment charges towards more normalised levels.
So within all of that slight jargon speak from the bank there, a sense that they're still going on the right track, things are still improving, and that they're ready for further commercial investment, or that they're an interesting investment opportunity for other people.
Well, we wouldn't like to say that, but the bank has, it says, continued to trade in line with its expectations. It's been helped by positive economic environments in both the UK and Ireland. It's also mentioning pay and jobs at Bank of Ireland. It says it's concluded its discussions with staff and their representatives, and that's in relation to future jobs and pay at the bank. And it says that this is going to lead to employees having a kind of more normal career framework there, and sustainable pay in the future.
So is that a pay increase?
That is up to the discussions that the IBOA and other staff representatives have with the bank.
Okay, well, let's move on to Ulster Bank then. They've, as you say, they've got some quarterly figures out this morning.
Yeah, and we're going to hear a little bit more about them at 10 to 8 when we talk to Jim Brown, Ulster Bank's chief executive. But Ulster Bank says it's in profit for the third 3 months in a row. So for the last 3 months of its financial year, the last quarter, it's been in profit, and it was for the previous two quarters as well. Its future is more clear. Its statement today says that an announcement also from RBS this morning.
The parent.
Yes, the parent bank sees the conclusion of the extensive strategic review of Ulster Bank, it says. And Royal Bank of Scotland has confirmed that Ulster Bank's core status is a good strategic fit with RBS's retail and commercial banking strategy.
So does that end speculation that maybe Ulster Bank wasn't that interested in being in the Irish market, or certainly doing much new business in the Irish market? There was a feel around the bank, wasn't there, at one point in relation to that?
Well, it was always up to RBS rather than Ulster Bank itself. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty clear indication from them in a statement this morning. Ulster Bank itself, the parent, or RBS itself, the parent company, this morning it reported pre-tax profits of £1.27 billion sterling for the 3 months to the end of September, and it said it has set aside £780 million sterling for litigation costs, and that's including costs related to the foreign exchange rate scandal still being investigated by regulators in the UK. And briefly, currencies, the euro is trading at $1.2577 and 78.73 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you very much. Thank you indeed, Arwin. The time is 7 minutes past seven, and here with It Says in the Papers is Caroline Murphy.
Surprise AIB rate cut to put pressure on rivals. That's the headline in the Irish Times today. The paper leads with a piece on what it says was AIB's first reduction in variable and fixed mortgage rates in 3 years. We're told the move will benefit 146,000 mortgage holders, that it partly reverses the bank's decision in April 2013 to increase rates despite a series of ECB cuts, and also that although other banks have declined to say if they'll be following suit, analysts believe the move is likely to trigger a response. That's the aspect which is highlighted in the Irish Independent page one piece on it. More banks will be forced to slash rates after AIB cut is the headline there. But for a lead story, the Independent and indeed the Irish Examiner and the Irish Daily Mail still go with Irish Water. The Independent leads with the bottom line for all of us. Water pressure rises, now €100 off every bill. The story says the government is planning to extend the water charges tax relief to ensure everyone is guaranteed €100 off their bill. And it adds, a cap on water charges is also under consideration, but householders with a meter would still be able to pay the metered rate if it was lower. The Examiner story, meanwhile, focuses on what happened yesterday. Rising tide of protests is its headline over a report on both the meeting between Irish Water officials and public representatives, which had to be abandoned in Cork, and also on arrests at a meter installation protest. And the Irish Daily Mail leads with a piece on the way they say the company is describing its chairperson. Neil Michael says Fianna Fáil TD Barry Cowan wants to know why Rose Hines's time as a director at Bank of Ireland is missing from her Irish Water online CV. Roy Keane's CV, meanwhile, is not going to include a stint on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, at least according to the Irish Sun. Keane No of the Jungle is the headline there. The paper says that the former Irish soccer star turned down a €500,000 offer to appear on the show. We're told ITV identified him as its all-time dream guest for it, but his response was, I met the jungle people, but I thought, nah, not for me. The Irish Daily Star, however, suggests it might be for him in the future. The story there says Keane refused to rule out appearing on the show. Otherwise, this morning, that Ebola hoax at Dublin Airport yesterday makes the lead in the Irish Daily Mirror. Plane madness is the headline on the piece about the detention of three people yesterday after a cup with Be Careful Ebola was handed to a flight attendant on an Aer Lingus flight from Milan. From the National Museum, meanwhile, news that it may have to close some of its sites or else charge for entry. The Times finds front page space for a report on its funding crisis. We're told that since 2008, Exchequer funding has decreased by 40%. And that a board meeting yesterday considered whether or not to ask Arts Minister Heather Humphreys to allow it to introduce entry charges. But finally this morning, we'd all have fewer charges and bills, perhaps, if we took on a minimalist lifestyle. The Independent has a feature on two men who've done just that and have written about it. It's not necessarily about throwing out everything you own, we're told. Just about getting excess out of the way and making room for what's really important, Christopher.
Caroline Murphy, 11 minutes past seven. Thank you very much indeed for that.
Later this morning at a ceremony at Áras an Uachtaráin, President Michael D. Higgins will appoint Emily Logan as Chief Commissioner of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. That's a merger of the Equality Authority and the Human Rights Commission. Their job, to make sure that the state meets up to its human rights and equality obligations. Emily Logan is here and you're very welcome. Congratulations on the appointment later this morning. What will you do and how will you do it?
Well, the new legislation, which commences tomorrow legally, the powers that are invested in the Commission will start tomorrow. And there's a range of very significant powers. The legal powers have been extended and they include, for instance, looking at equality legislation. We have 50 live cases in relation to equality legislation where people can seek legal assistance through our work. We also have the opportunity to act as what's described as amicus curiae, and we have a lot of live cases going on in relation to that at the moment that thematically, just to give people an example of things like housing, trafficking, we have a case of extradition. We also have a case of relating to the retention of telecommunications information. So there's some very significant legal powers, commenting on legislation and inquiry powers. In addition to that, the softer powers, but the ones that I'm really think will change the commission for people, is the engagement powers. So we have an obligation to promote human rights and equality. In addition to that, we have a role to promote intercultural understanding. To do that, that's about education. It's about interacting with civil society who may be closer to some communities than we are as a commission, hearing directly from people themselves, from all sorts of communities. And in particular, we're going to try and encourage people to support people to exercise their own rights. So it's not simply about people advocating on their behalf, but also hearing directly from people themselves.
You're going to be reporting to the Oireachtas and not the Minister for Justice as the two former bodies would have. Why and what difference, if any, would that make?
Well, this is very significant in terms of, just by way of background, the genesis of the commission has its origins in the Good Friday and Belfast Agreement. So we have a commission in both north and south of the island. So it's a requirement of the Belfast Agreement. And essentially, this is really about putting the Human Rights Commission on a very independent footing. So instead of reporting to the Minister, we will now report to the Oireachtas. In addition to that, the second key change in terms of accountability.
What difference does that make?
What difference does it make? It alters completely the relationship that the Commission have with the Oireachtas.
How?
So we will account. Well, there are three things. The first is that we have to produce our first strategy. We have to put that before the Oireachtas. We have to account in our annual report to the Oireachtas. In terms of our financial accountability, we now have a director who's an accounting officer who will account directly.
But what difference does it make doing that to the Oireachtas as opposed to the Minister for Justice?
It makes the office much more powerful than it had been in the past. It also ensures that you're operating in a space that's unfettered in terms of any interference from government. So it assures the independence.
The office is dominated by government.
Well, I think what you, certainly my experience as an ombudsman and an independent officer for the last 10 years is that your work is taken much more seriously. You get much more opportunity to interact across parties throughout the Oireachtas, and it gives credibility and a status to the work that's really important.
Niall Crowley resigned, it's nearly 6 years ago now, as chief executive of the Equality Authority because its funding was cut almost by half at the time, 43%. What did you make of that?
Look, this is a six-year-old story. I'm not going to spend the next 5 years of my term talking about something that happened 6 years ago. That was a very personal choice for Niall Crowley. My job for the next 5 years is to assure that we have adequate funding
to do
the job. I believe that we do. For starters, we have an increase of 2 million given by the Minister for Justice this year. We have a budget of 6.3 million, a staffing of 47. And we're about to embark. Remember, we're about to embark on our very first strategy. So we haven't even appointed all of those staff. We've only about 22 staff. So it's almost like a startup rather than a merger. So it's far too early to say whether that budget is adequate. Come back in a year's time and I'll give you a better answer.
The Human Rights Commission wanted an independent inquiry into the Magdalen laundries. Now, the then Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, said no. What do you think?
Well, I think our work as a commission is to try to give advice to the government on any of those kind of inquiries. I mean, I'm meeting with James Riley, the Minister for Children, next week in relation to the mother and baby homes for the same reason that we would look at the equality and human rights framework in carrying out any kind of inquiry. And there are three key things that should be looked at. The first is that any inquiry like that should be statutory. It should have the relevant powers in terms of compellability of documents and witnesses. And crucially, they should hear directly from survivors.
What else do you want to look at?
Well, I mean, we've a very broad range of powers in relation to the the legislation provides a very broad range of powers. So it's anything in relation to civil and political rights, economic, social, cultural rights. And it's right across the gamut of human rights. I mean, this week we saw a number of issues. For instance, the UNICEF report on child poverty. We saw the Lydia Foy case and withdrawal of that legal action on the basis that the government is committed to enacting the gender recognition bill. We saw the events in Waterford. I mean, every week there'll be something. So we're not going to pick off issues. We're going to develop a strategy that allows us to work in a way that will engage with live issues.
I see your old job as being advertised today in this morning's newspaper, that of Children's Ombudsman. Any advice for anybody who's interested in the job?
Oh, I shouldn't. I don't think it's good to be advising anyone coming in, but I absolutely loved the 10 years. It's a fantastic opportunity of influence. And just to go back to that, being an independent officer and reporting to the Oireachtas is really critical in terms of the credibility of the institution.
Emily Logan, thank you very much for coming into us and good luck on your new job.
The Irish Times newspaper yesterday reported a return to profits for last year, but for many people who like to browse its website, it says it's putting in place a metered paywall if you want to read content on the website from next year. The technical platform for what's called a digital pass is being worked on right now. Roy Greenslade is Professor of Journalism at City University in London. He's also a blogger with The Guardian. He joins us on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. This idea of a paywall to read something that we've had for free from the Irish Times. I don't think anyone would doubt that it's a good brand with good content. It's a bit like the water here. We've had it for free, but now we're going to be charged for it. How's it likely to go down with people?
That's always difficult to say, but there has to be some way, it's felt, to actually fund journalism. If you're giving it away for free, to use that phrase, then eventually there'll come a time when you can't afford to offer anything at all. So all newspaper groups, all media outlets are trying to find ways of monetizing their content, and the paywall is one of the ways of doing it. Whether it's successful or not is a moot point, but they're going for what's called a soft paywall. In other words, they're going to give you some articles for free, and then after you've read, and they'll set a limit, it could be 10 a day or 10 a week or 20 a week or whatever, at that point you'll be told, okay, you've had your free content, now it's time to pay up.
How, if you're a business, do you survive a paywall if so much of the news out there is for free, and indeed there are instances where, you know, you can go to a newspaper, perhaps like the Financial Times, you can see the string, if you like, or the URL across the top. You can only read a certain amount of the article, but you can put in a Google search with that URL and the whole thing comes up. I mean, it's quite leaky, isn't it, a paywall?
Well, some are. I mean, there are hard paywalls where you can't do that. So, for instance, the Times in London, you can't penetrate it in that manner. I think the FT do allow that to occur. I'm not quite certain why, but I think that's because their paywall overall has been very successful. They've got 455,000 subscribers, which for a niche publication is pretty good. You have to pay a fairly high amount to do it. But, of course, a business paper like the Financial Times is very useful to people, and also it's sold anyway or wanted by what we might call upscale or high-end or very affluent people, so it's no trouble for them. I think when it comes to general news, it's much more difficult. So what you have to say is our content is so good, so unique and so much wanted that we think people are going to be prepared to pay for it. So general news, breaking news, will always be available, easily available now via Twitter anyway. But when it comes to analysis or commentary, then I think quality newspapers feel that their content is such that people will be prepared to pay for it. By the way, there's no unanimity about this. We're in a kind of digital laboratory here in which people are trying out different methods. So The Guardian, say, and The Daily Mail, their websites are free. They've built up huge volume, and they believe that by building up the volume, they will get the advertisers. I think the Irish Times believes that it's largely a smaller publication. It's not yet got a standing internationally. It can't get the volume, so therefore it's going for what we might call a niche audience, and that niche audience has got to be prepared to pay, because if they don't pay, they won't have the money to fund their journalists.
Ultimately, how successful are traditional newspapers at generating digital income? How has that been, if you like, looking across the landscape?
Well, some have done pretty well. I mentioned the Daily Mail. That seems to have done exceedingly well. The Financial Times, as I mentioned, has done well. The New York Times has done pretty well, although their subscriptions, which were running, I think, at something like 800,000, 830,000, have started to level off. But they say that their digital income is pretty good. Everyone does say that, of course, but it is it's really difficult to know. Everyone's experimenting, and I think this is a time when we've reached that level of digital disruption that it's really, I think, necessary for everyone to innovate in the hope that they can find some decent way of getting revenue.
Roy Greenslade, Professor of Journalism at City University in London, thank you for joining us.
To Israel now, where a key holy site will reopen today after a tense week in Jerusalem. The Haram al-Sharif, or Temple Mount, one of Islam and Judaism's holiest sites, was closed after the shooting of a Jewish activist on Wednesday night. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas described the closure as a declaration of war. Yesterday, Israeli police shot dead a Palestinian man suspected of the killing. Dan Williams is a journalist with Reuters. He's based in Jerusalem. Good morning, Dan. The end of a very messy week there. What's the mood in Jerusalem this morning?
Well, as you noted, there was a decision to reopen access or limited access for Muslim prayer on the Al-Aqsa compound, known to Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. Jews are not allowed up there, but that's always been the case on Friday, Saturdays, when it is the focus of routine weekly Muslim prayer. And also, so there is Jewish prayer nearby at the Western Wall, which is part of the exterior of the complex. Now, so far things have been quiet. It's worth noting that winter rains have arrived here. That always dampens political violence. And in general, when there has been violence around the Al-Aqsa compound on Fridays, it's been toward the end of Muslim prayer, and that tends to be in the mid-afternoon, the early afternoon. So time will tell, but I think certainly on the Israeli side and possibly on the Palestinian side, there is some hope that at least this episode can be wrapped up in relative quiet.
Two high-profile shootings this week, one fatality, and that's not the end of the violence this week in Jerusalem.
Well, so far in terms of fatal violence, perhaps there were cases before. There have been a string of attacks in and around the Jerusalem area. They seem to focus on a district of Jerusalem called Silwan. It's just outside the old city walls. It's in East Jerusalem, which also the shrine we discussed is also part of East Jerusalem. These are areas captured from Jordan by Israel in the 1967 war and among areas claimed by the Palestinians for a future state. Now, Palestinians have been very upset about gradual Jewish settlement of Silwan, encouraged by the Israeli government, which of course sees Silwan as part of the Israeli capital, even though that's not recognized, that status abroad. And we've had two residents, well, actually one resident of Silwan, one resident of a nearby neighborhood called Abu Tor, who apparently carried out lethal or attacks or attempted attacks this week. One of them on a man called Yehuda Glick, who is a U.S.-born Israeli activist for increased Jewish access to the Al-Aqsa compound, which Palestinians see as a threat to the Muslim shrine there, which is the third most important in Islam. So if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a matter of territory, and I don't think there is any doubt it's a matter of very close contested territory, then there's probably no better a focal point than the Al-Aqsa compound and the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where it's not just a matter of disputed territory, it's also a matter of a very, very intense and ancient religious dispute. And that is what has come to a head this week.
7:30, I'll come to news headlines in just a moment. You mentioned settlements and also territory. I see the UN Human Rights Committee is urging Israel to halt settlement building in the West Bank this week.
Yes, I think that's a standard international line. I don't think that's new. That's also a line that has been supported by, certainly by the European Union. The United States has, well, have a more moderate statement saying the settlements are unhelpful. But in general, Israel has pursued settlement growth, or at least settlements it says would obviously remain within its grasp and annexed under any peace deal with the Palestinians. That does not square with the international vision, which is urged by the Palestinians and other major regional players like Jordan, which has a major stake in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, in saying that this must be halted at the very least as a goodwill gesture to keep negotiations going. Negotiations have been stalled now for several months. The Israelis are pursuing policies that they think are legitimate, but that hasn't met with much understanding or acceptance or agreement abroad.
Dan Williams with Reuters in Jerusalem. Thank you very much. Des Cahill is here with the Sports News. Morning, Des.
Morning to you, Gavin. We're starting with news of golf. The BMW Masters in Shanghai. Big prize money here. Second round drawing to a close. Belgium's Nicholas Coulthard leads. He's had a great round. He's 13 under par. And two Irishmen are sharing eighth place, so they're still very much in contention. Shane Lowry shot a brilliant 66. He's 8 under par, 5 off the lead, along with Graham McDowell, who dropped a shot. He dropped back from 9. He was in third place. Michael Hoey has finished on 6 under par. Paul McGilley has just finished on level par. Now, the remarkable run of injuries to hit the Irish rugby squad continued yesterday. And worst of all for Joe Schmidt, the latest two players to drop out of the squad for the Autumn Internationals are both props. There's a lot of injuries in the front row. Munster prop James Cronin will be out for a minimum 6 weeks because of an ankle injury he picked up playing against Saracens last weekend. And Nathan White also ruled out earlier yesterday. The Connacht prop ruptured a tendon in his arm. He requires surgery and he'll be out for about 4 months. In the Pro 12 League, both Leinster and Connacht are in action tonight. Leinster host Edinburgh at the RDS, while Connacht travel to Wales. They take on Ospreys and both games kick off at 7:35. Now, in Gaelic games, Pat Flanagan has been confirmed as the new manager of the Offaly senior and under 21 football teams. He has recently been manager in Sligo and Westmeath. He succeeds Emmett MacDonald. As expected, Brian Whelan will remain in his role as the Offaly hurling manager. And Donegal are to name their new football manager tonight. Their county committee meeting was to be on Monday, but has been brought forward to this evening.
Any idea who it might be?
I don't know. I guess it'll be Raymond Gallagher, but I don't know. meanwhile, Rory, as you know, was sidekick to Jim McGuinness in their successful year 2012, and he seems to be what they're saying in Donegal, but I don't know. I'm bound to be wrong now. Premier Division Soccer could return to Galway tonight. They carry a 2-1 lead into the second leg of their promotion relegation playoff against UCD, and the game at DC Park has a 7:45 kickoff. Now, this weekend is dominated by the two FAI Cup finals. Later in the programme, we'll be looking ahead to the women's final, where Raheny United take on UCD Waves. But now we're going to hear from two of the players in the men's final as St Patrick's Athletic take on Derry City. First, Chris Forrester of St Pat's as they bid to end a barren run of over half a century in the Cup.
Yeah, that's the plan. Hopefully we can win the Cup this year. You know, I don't want to feel that heartbreak again. I hear a lot of the fans talk about the 53-year hoodoo and stuff, but I'm not concentrating on that. I'm concentrating on winning, and that's all I want to do. It's been an okay season. I'm happy with how it went. Obviously losing the league to Dundalk was a bit upsetting, but no, we got to the Cup final and hopefully we can win that, and we got a European place as well, so it's been an okay season individually and collectively for the team. At the start of the season they were a bit all over the place, and then we played them here, we bet them 4-2. I think they weren't really much of a team, they were all over the place, you know, and I think they've really kicked on towards the end of the season. I think Peter Hutton took over and they've kind of took the in well, and they've obviously been playing well and got to the Cup final for it.
Indeed they have, and Derry will bring a big support to the Aviva. The Derry captain, Barry Malloy, has happy memories of previous finals.
I know what it's all about. You know, I've been on the terraces when I've watched Cup finals in the past and that, and I've watched our manager score a winner, you know, in 95 as well. So I've been on the stands and I know what it's all about to play for Derry, and I think it's going to be even more a special occasion, the fact that I'm leading the boys out.
Why do you think the FAA Cup final has become such an open, entertaining affair? Because we've seen some cracking finals over the last number of years.
Obviously, it's the end of a season, you know, and both teams are going for it. They're giving it their all, and they're usually entertaining games, and any game I've been involved in, they've been very entertaining, and that's the quality of the sides, but the fact that everyone's giving their all, they try and win it.
It's hard to shy away from the league form, you know, and league results over the last number of weeks, but, you know, you just seem to be able to turn it on in the Cup. But is it a concern that the team hasn't been playing that well recently?
Well, I think all season in the league we've been very inconsistent, to be honest. You know, there's one occasion where we'll be top drawer playing against the best teams, and then we'll let ourselves slip as such, you know. But I think, to be fair, in the Cup games we've been able to switch it on for one reason or another, and we did that against Shamrock Rovers, we've done it against Drogheda, where we performed really well, and we just have to try and replicate that now on Sunday, and that's our sole goal for that.
It'll be interesting to see how that one turns out. Celtic winger Alexander Tonev has been handed a 7-match ban after being found guilty of using racist insults by the Scottish FA. It occurred in an incident involving Aberdeen defender Shay Logan last month. It's a very strong penalty and probably sends out a message that I think others feel the English FA haven't been strong enough on. There are two race meetings today, Downroyal and Dundalk. Downroyal begins at 1:05 and Dundalk at 5:40.
Des, thank you very much. After the hour, we'll be hearing the latest on those water charge protests planned for around 80 locations and counting around the country tomorrow. No firm indication of the numbers who'll participate in those rallies, but 3 weeks ago there were conflicting estimates. At least, though, 50,000 people attended the large protest in Dublin. Pat Rabbit is the former Minister for Communications, Energy and Natural Resources. He's now on the back benches. He's on the line for us this morning. Good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, we are in a very difficult situation if you were a government minister this morning. What should the government be doing?
Well, I think the real concern out there is about affordability and certainty. There are a lot of people who are very apprehensive. They don't know or aren't not believing or not certain about how much will water charges cost them. And that clarity and certainty isn't there. But at the same time, I think most people understand that our water system is poor, in some cases derelict, and that we're going to have to dig out the network and refurbish the network. In some parts of the country, the water is not fit to drink. In other parts of the country in the past, we've had cryptosporidium, for example, in Galway, doing terrible damage to the tourism sector. This requires enormous investment, in excess of $1 billion a year for maybe a decade. It will create an awful lot of employment, but the state doesn't have the $1 billion. So the reason it set up a new company in public ownership to provide, treat, supply water is that new company will be able to go to the markets to borrow the investment that is necessary to give us a water system that's fit for purpose.
Why do you think at this 11th hour that key message has been so poorly received or misunderstood or even deliberately misunderstood by so many quarters?
Well, I don't know. I think you're right about being deliberately misunderstood in some quarters. I mean, people are very apprehensive after 6 years of hardship that has affected some people very badly due to the banking collapse and recession. They're tired of charges, and that mood is being exploited by the same people who gave you the anti-bin charges protest.
Picking up on that,
remember where the anti-bin charges protests led to. It led to the privatization of the bin service, and it led to people not being able to pay bin charges, and there was illegal dumping here in my own constituency at the time. So, you know, there is no danger. It's an entire red herring about privatization of our water services. There won't be any privatization of our water services. It's enshrined in law, and no government with its head screwed on would seek to privatize something as critical as the water supply.
You were a supervising minister during the formation, or much of the formation, of this new utility. If you could...
No, I wasn't. I was responsible for the parent company, Bord Gáis, but I wasn't involved with Irish Water.
You were at the cabinet, and indeed, Alex White, your successor, attended a meeting yesterday in relation to Irish Water. So, I suppose looking at the continuum there. But if you were to reflect on what government did in the first half of its life, in relation to Irish Water, what would you say it could have done better?
Well, I think the a great deal of the problem stems from the fact that under the cosh of the Troika, the government sought to telescope the time frame for the proper implementation of such a monumental undertaking as the creation of a national water supply. You know, the expert advice across the water, for example, where water companies have been established, is that it would take 3 to 5 years. Here, under constant pressure from the Troika, the government sought to have it underway in 2 years. That time frame was too short and is the root cause of some of the difficulties that are now confronting us.
Of course,
it would have been better if the entire purpose of this exercise had been better explained to people. There is no way that Ireland is going to escape within the European Union without paying for water. There is no way that Ireland can go on suffering the lack of investment in the water services that we have been for 25 years. We have 1% headroom in this city now. We were turning off the water here in my constituency last winter. Other parts of the country can't use the water that's coming out of the taps.
Would you accept that there are people out there who feel hunted? I'll just give you one example. People whose adult children are living at home with them for very good reason. Either they're out of employment or can't get on the property ladder. They now feel that they're being penalised at a huge rate. Not only have they suffered once, but there's no exemption, there's no credits for that category of person. And that's just one example.
I do agree with you. I think it is a real problem. I have encountered it myself. I think that's why I say that the nub of the issue, when you clear away all the distractions, is affordability. And people are apprehensive that they don't know with certainty what will the charge be as we proceed. And the particular category you mentioned of people, young people who are either unemployed or still in education, living at home, is an issue where the shoe pinches.
It sounds...
Now, I don't know anything, and I don't want to be misrepresented. I don't know anything about the meeting of the Economic Management Council yesterday, nor has any member of the Economic Management Council told me anything about what happened yesterday. But in my view, there are a couple of obvious areas that have to be addressed, and I would have every confidence that the new minister, Alan Kelly, will seek to do that insofar as he can within the strictures on him by state aid rules in terms of how much the state can intervene and to what extent.
Do you think it would be a brave government that would rip up the current charging structure? I think most people would acknowledge it's hard to understand, it's hard to grasp, and start afresh.
Well, you know, I think the important thing is to start to more calmly explain why we're embarked on this enterprise. This is a huge undertaking to create a public utility that is capable of delivering quality water to businesses and residences throughout the entire country. And we need to explain why, you know, during the years of the boom, the investment ought to have gone in then. It didn't. we're at risk. I mean, there are companies coming into this country now for which water and broadband are now as critical as energy. And the water supply is absolutely essential, and it's at risk. It's not adequate. Some of the piping system is derelict from the Victorian age. We don't have the investment as an exchequer to do that work. Therefore, you know, I recall in 2011 when this country couldn't borrow €2 on the markets, that the ESB were able to go to the markets and raise funding in order to refurbish and maintain the electricity transmission system. Now, we need to build a public utility in water that is capable of doing the same thing off the balance sheet of the government and off the national accounts.
And, Pat
and
Rabbit,
that's the huge challenge that Minister Kelly has to meet, because there are strictures on him in terms of how much he can do.
And we must leave it there. But Pat Rabbit, thank you very much for joining us.
9 minutes to 8. More business news now. Emma's back.
Thanks, Gavin. Briefly, Bank of Ireland says the level of default to loans has continued to fall. Customer deposits are rising, as is new lending, and that's according to an interim management statement out today. The statement says the level of defaulted loans on its books stood at €16.4 billion by the end of September, down €1.9 billion on June last year, and that reflects improved conditions in the Irish and British economies. Now to Ulster Bank, and its results are accompanied by a statement on the end of a strategic review of Ulster Bank by its parent, Royal Bank of Scotland. This morning, RBS has confirmed Ulster's status as a good strategic fit with RBS's retail and commercial banking strategy. It says this will be a challenger bank in the Republic of Ireland with a stronger position in Northern Ireland and closer ties to RBS itself. Ulster Bank today announced profits of €485 million, its third financial three-month period in profit. We're joined now by its chief executive, Jim Brown. Jim Brown, a challenger bank. Good morning. A challenger bank. Now that you don't have a question mark over your future anymore, how are you going to do that?
Well, I think first of all, today's results confirm that we're in good shape. As you mentioned, we made a good quarterly profit, which is the third for us for this year. But the review, which was extensive, has just been completed, and it confirmed that Ulster Bank is core to RBS. We've got a very good position in the market here, and the group sees that there's good opportunities in Ireland. I think as a consequence of that, there is a real opportunity for us to be a real challenger bank to the two pillar banks.
Now, you had been tipped for a sale or outside investment. You lost more than £2.5 billion in the last 2 years, yet you employ 6,000 staff of about 200 branches, 2 million customers on the island. How much of the commitment this morning from RBS is to do with rising property prices, especially in Dublin?
No, I think the review was very extensive, and it's not unusual, I don't think, or unreasonable to have gone through a review such as this following the crisis that that the market went through. But RBS, as part of the review, saw that we do have a very good business here. We are turning around that business, but also there's huge opportunities across the island of Ireland to improve our position.
And RBS says you're going to deliver attractive returns with appropriate investment. Where will we see that investment?
Well, we're looking at we're still a full-service bank right across the island, so we're very strong in retail and SME lending, and also in corporate as well. We'll continue to invest in those areas, but there's other parts of those businesses where we see the real opportunities to do more than what we're doing today. Some examples of that would be doing more in consumer lending, particularly around unsecured lending, more on asset-backed financing to help businesses buy plant and equipment and so on. But there are other areas aside from those as well. But those will be a couple of key areas for us.
What about mortgage interest rates? Are you going to challenge AIB by following its reduction yesterday?
Well, we've already led rates in that. We came out with some new mortgage loans for fixed rate loans, mortgage rates for fixed rate loans, 3 years, 5 years, seven-year loans just a couple of weeks ago. And we've seen a strong demand for that as well. But we'll keep the variable rates under review for sure.
Your statement and Bank of Ireland's this morning say that the UK and Ireland are seeing signs of growth. How does a bank measure that?
Well, we're seeing growth across a number of sectors, just in terms of economic activity or GDP. We're seeing strong growth there in Ireland this year. We've seen unemployment coming down, employment rising, so more jobs being created. We're seeing more happening in retail spending, and there's also more activity in the housing market. So we're seeing, increases right across the board there. That's then turning into an increase in demand and lending for us as well. So we've seen an increase in lending of 35% year on year.
Yet you also note a challenging business environment for your customers. How is that manifested?
Well, I think even though things are turning around and the economy is improving, it's still tough out there. We still have issues with some businesses who have some difficulty on their loans. Clearly, people still have some issues on their mortgages as well. But we're out there talking to customers in those situations, putting solutions in place to help them. And in fact, if we look at our mortgage arrears, we've seen an improvement in our arrears for 18 months now, month on month. And we've had 8,000 customers who were in arrears who are now back paying their loans.
Let's look at your staff. They've had a stressful few years. Now that you have the backing of your parents and that question mark is gone, will the staff be expecting any changes in pay and conditions?
Well, we're already in discussions looking at that as we speak. So I've been talking about that for the last month or two.
Jim Brown, Chief Executive of Ulster Bank, thanks very much for joining us. Very briefly, let's look at the currency markets. The euro this morning is trading at $1.2577 and at 78.73 pence sterling.
It is 4 minutes to 8 o'clock now. Will the nation's smaller witches and zombies get wet as they go around trick-or-treating tonight? Over to Joan Blackburn at Met Aaron.
Thanks and good morning everyone from Met Aaron. Well, it is going to be very mild today, but we will have rain about and some people, I'm afraid, will get wet during the evening time. But as I said, very mild today. Temperatures of 14 to 18 degrees expected this afternoon. Then it looks like turning cooler tomorrow and generally much colder and very unsettled weather expected for Sunday through midweek, and some night frost can be expected. But for today, very mild and breezy or windy in places this morning. There will be spells of heavy rain through much of Munster, Connacht and West Ulster, and the yellow rainfall warning continues in operation. Drier further east this morning, with just scattered outbreaks of rain and some brighter periods at first. Now, that heavier rain will be spreading eastwards during the afternoon and early evening, and the rain will tend to ease off through western areas, and it should clear there around nightfall, so better for the trick-or-treaters in the west. Afternoon temperatures of 14 to 17 or possibly 18 degrees in a few eastern areas this afternoon, but it will be turning cooler this evening as the clearer air pushes along eastwards. That remaining rain will clear off early tonight, with clear periods and some scattered showers following. It's going to be much cooler tonight than last night, with the overnight lows of 6 to 9 degrees, and we could see some patchy mist developing in places. Cool and bright tomorrow morning with sunny spells and a few showers. Then cloudy, windy, wet conditions will develop through western coastal counties by noon. And then this band of heavy rain will spread quickly eastwards during the afternoon, with some very heavy downpours possible in places, but clearing away again during the evening or early Saturday night. Highs tomorrow of 11 to 14 degrees. And the outlook then is for rather chilly, unsettled weather. Cool and breezy on Sunday with sunny spells and scattered heavy showers in the morning. Showers could well merge to bring some longer spells of rain to Atlantic counties during the afternoon. Temperatures on Sunday, 9 to 13 degrees. There is a risk of some strong winds in some Atlantic coastal districts on Sunday night, with further rain or showers. Then it looks like rather cold conditions on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, with sharp frosts by night as temperatures fall close to zero. Fairly widespread heavy showers through Monday, prolonged in places with the risk of thunder locally. The showers, however, should become mostly confined to the coastal counties on Tuesday, with better sunny breaks, but some hail or isolated thunderstorms are likely in the coastal fringes. It looks like Wednesday will be largely dry, with good sunny spells and northwest winds falling off light. Temperatures in the afternoons about 8 to 10 degrees, but possibly colder in northern areas through Monday. That's all for me. Good morning.